good weekend, folks. Nice to speak with you. Once again, I'm Henry Collingdon, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. We are glad to have you with us. By the way, as a follow-up to our last show that we did with Nick Kellerstrom, I hope that you got a chance to look at the video that we had up as the top featured story over the weekend called Spielberg's Hoax, The Last Days of the Big Lie. Absolutely outrageous. It's hilarious, shocking, and I think you'll be completely floored if you haven't seen this before. I recommend that you look at it. It's on redicecreations.com right now. Not as top story, but scroll down a bit and look for Spielberg's Hoax, The Last Days of the Big Lie. Well, today we have something different for you. We are going to look at an older topic, if you will, something we haven't looked at for some time, but with a new twist to it. Ishtar Babilodingir is a former Sunday Times journalist who now is a shaman. She is the creator of Ishtar's Gate and the Holistic Works. She's also the author of The Sacred Sex Rites of Ishtar, about ancient shamanic sex practices, and also The Lord of the Dance, a book about her time in India. We are going to look at the issue of human biodiversity, biology, heritage, tradition, culture, and race from a more metaphysical or a spiritual perspective. Our angle is going to be a bit different today, but I think it's important to look at the issues we speak about from different angles, and have people understand that when we speak about the current ongoing destruction and erosion of European cultures, and specifically British culture, Celtic and Anglo-Saxon heritage, which we'll be speaking about here today, it's not just about the biology, or that the issue is anchored simply in, you know, skin color or fish and chips or something superficial like that, that some people suggest. We are talking about something that is much more deeper and far more ancient. We are going to speak more about the importance of blood, DNA, and our ancestors, their wisdom, but also geography, the land, our land, that has shaped us into who we are, something that makes us all very different. And we'll speak more about why it is so important to preserve these differences for the sake of true diversity, but also then from a more metaphysical perspective. We'll begin to speak a little bit more about the difference between the New Age and the kind of shamanism that Ishtar will be speaking more about today. So do stay with us if you want to hear more. I hope you enjoy. Well, thank you for coming on the program, Ishtar. Good to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here.
You bet. We are glad to have you. We've posted some of your articles on redicecreations.com over the years on a lot of the more metaphysical topics about the spirits of the land and the importance, of course, of where you are over in England. A lot of fascinating work that you've pulled out there. But it was really an article about race and folk spirit and the importance of land that actually prompted me to want to bring you on. And it's not that I'm not interested in the other topics, far from it, but I have a feeling of an urgency these days in the way that the people in most European countries are being, well, pushed up against the wall, for the lack of a better term, on in so many different ways. The demographics are being rapidly altered, and the conversation out there is largely non-existent in the media anyway. And that's why I find it so important to address the issue, to give space to this question, especially when women also decide to speak up on the matter, since unfortunately this is rare as well. And it's even better than, I think, when we can have a focus on the spiritual aspect to our folk and our connection to the land, that this is something ancient, this is something that not is just coming out of the blue, a modern thing. And I think that this is at the root of things. It's not about the superficial biological stuff, although this is an expression of those metaphysical principles, of course. And this is something I want to try to get a little bit deeper into, Ishtar, here in this program. But why don't you just tell us a little bit about your work here in the beginning as a way of kind of bringing people up to speed who might not be aware of your work?
Yes. I'm a shaman. And a shaman is someone who journeys into other dimensions to get guidance from the entities that he or she meets there, known as the spirits. And we bring back that guidance or information or healing to our community or to individuals that we're working with in a form of healing. So that's basically what a shaman is. And it seems that shamanism was practiced all over the earth millennia ago. It seems that There was a very interesting book that came out in 1951, which exposed this, actually, by someone called Mercier Eliade. And Mercier Eliade was a professor of the history of religion at Harvard. And one day he was rooting around in his cupboards, and he came across this whole sheaf of papers. And when he pulled it out and dusted it off, he saw that it was actually lots and lots and lots of interviews by anthropologists who traveled all around the world interviewing shamans around the time of the end of the 19th century and the earliest 20th century. So they had come back, filed their reports about all these shamans that they discovered everywhere, and then they had all just been shoved in a cupboard because, as you know, as we'll see as we go on with this discussion, shamanism doesn't fit in to the current narrative. It's about spiritual self-empowerment, which really is the opposite of what's being propagated right now in terms of religion. And I include science in religion as well. I think science is just religion without the God bit. But these are all just faith-based belief systems that have nothing, they're collective systems. They have nothing to do with individual self-empowerment, which is what shamanism leads to. So anyway, Mercier Eliade was a Romanian, and he published he went through all these and he collated them. And what he found was that there were so many similar practices all over the world that the shamans seemed to be going into very similar experiences and doing very similar healing work, like soul retrievals, shape-shifting, psychopomping the dead, in very similar ways. And these shamans, you know, you had a shaman in Australia and one in Africa, and they couldn't possibly have met each other. And so it was like, why was there this common belief system all over the world? It couldn't be explained, really. And he published that book in 1951. And from then on in, he was completely demonized, accused of being anti-Semitic. They dug up something from his youth where he was he was actually not even a part of the Iron Guard, but he had friends in the Prussian Iron Guard, which had some, it was supposed to be anti-Semitic or fascist or something. But it was just like, you know, we've all done things in our youth, you know, we flirted with different ideas as we were trying to find our way through. And anyway, so the book vanished without trace for quite some time until some other anthropologists got hold of it in the 60s and started to think, well, look, we want to go out and study this, so let's do it. And so they went out various places in the world, Africa, India, Australia, and started working with the indigenous tribes to try and understand what shamanism is. But because they were approaching it from a scientific point of view, because they didn't want to infect it with their own subjective experience, because you can't if you're, you know, the whole thing about science is it has to be objective. They weren't really getting anywhere until one of them said, well, I think we're just going to have to need to do this in order to really know what it is. And there were a few really quite well-known ones that did that and brought it back to the West and started training up other people like myself to do it. And so that's how I came into it, because I met one of those anthropologists who was doing the training. And that was my official training, although I had some unofficial training before that. The thing with this is if someone says to you, when did you start your training as a shaman? The spirits take an interest in you at a much, much earlier date than when you even realize it. And so your training starts almost from birth, really. But you don't really realize it until you've gone on the official course. And then you look back and you see how these spirits were always there. And we all have these spirits. The shaman isn't special. We all have this built into us. It's our birthright. So I came into this from, I was a journalist, and I was a journalist on the Sunday Times, and I was writing about alternative health and environmental matters. And in those days, I was always much more interested in the mind-body-spirit side of alternative health, and I still am. And so that's how I started traveling around the world, talking to different people about different spiritual healing. I was a Reiki master for some time and had, you know, trained lots and lots of people in Reiki. I met my first shaman on a Greek island in mid-1990s. An American woman called Raven, worked with her for a short while. Then I was in India. I was in an Indian ashram and for about 6 months in 1998, and I met some Mexican shaman women there, and I spent a lot of time with them. But it wasn't until I came back to England that I started my proper training with a shaman here, who is one of these anthropologists that I mentioned.
Right. Yeah, very good. I'll ask you a little bit more about that in the beginning. Now, let me ask you something else here, because I think it's important, of course, to emphasize the spiritual aspects to who we are as a mechanism to anchor us in the real world and as a way to have some kind of rooting without us being just bounced around in the way that we are today between ideologies and between all these things. And it's clear that, you know, people are very, very confused, for lack of a better term. But let's just clarify one thing. What is the ancient connection to this then, and that connects these things to the activities of our ancestors, as opposed to, let's say, the emerging new age that we've seen in recent years and the way that some of this has been popularized? Is there a difference between these, do you think?
Yes, I think there's a huge difference. I think the new age is actually... I mean, I have some very extreme views on this, but I think the New Age is actually MKUltra writ large on the baby boomer generation. And because I remember very well the late 60s and early 70s and how easy it was to get LSD. And it was coming, as we now know, from intelligence sources. You know, this is where the LSD came from. The whole music scene and everything has always been infected with it. I was at the first ever Glastonbury Festival for my sins in 1971. So I went through that whole, what probably people would call the hippie scene. And I sort of saw it up close, what was going on. I now see the New Age is very much a muddying of the water exercise. From my point of view as a shaman, they bring out these false religions like Ascensionism, UFOs, ETs, that muddy the waters of shamanism. And you find people that practice some of these things, that are into some of these things, actually calling themselves shamans, and they're nothing. It's nothing to do with the original shamanism at all. The original shamanism has a huge, long tradition behind it, and you need that tradition, because I've now been a practicing shaman for over 10 years, and I feel like I'm still a beginner. Because it's so, you know, without the connection to the land and the ancestors, which is what we were talking about, then, and that has been so taken away from people.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you can't practice shamanism if you're living in a one-bedroom flat in a city that you weren't born in and you never go out into the woods, but it would be difficult. The shaman relies on the ancestral wisdom of his own ancestors, which he contacts through the DNA, which are in the fairy lore, it's referred to as the rivers of blood. And this is a metaphysical physiology. It's not like you can cut someone open and find rivers of blood. Most of the DNA, in fact, is metaphysical. The bit that we see, the spiral, is a very small part of it. And it is a way of contacting the ancestors. And the ancestors hold the wisdom of who the human being really is, what the human being is really doing here, what the destiny of the human being is. And everyone's destiny is different. So it can't ever be taught in a religion. There's no dogma. There's no belief system. I have trained a few people how to do this. It's called an initiation. You need to be initiated by a shaman. But everybody has the works inside of them to be able to do this. They just need to be initiated by a shaman. And then I just show them how to go into trance, how to journey, how to communicate with the spirits, because they have their own way of communicating, and a few other things like that. But then after that, they're good to go. And sometimes I never see them again. And I don't need to, because this isn't about religion. It's not about a collective belief system or blind faith or believing in something. And then if you believe in it, when you die, you'll go to heaven or any of that. It's about ecstasy here and now. It's actually about ecstasy. And it's been, I was mentioning Mercier Eliot earlier, and his book is something like Shamanism, the Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy. And when you're in this ecstasy, you're in the spirit world. It's very ecstatic experience. And you are transforming into your true being, your true self, which is godlike. But it has to be a transformation. There has to be this exchange of energy that happens between the shaman and the spirit. Am I going too fast, too far, too fast?
No worries at all. I wanted to ask you a little bit about how we get to the root of what practices our ancestors was involved in. I think it's easier, to a certain extent, to, as Mercier Eliot did, he looked at other cultures, because in some cases they were in a state where they hadn't transformed or changed or whatever you want to call it too much, meaning that there's still an access to some of these things back in the, you know, 20s and 30s, 40s, 50s, etc. There's a lot of works that come out of this period where Western scholars go to other parts of the world to see what they were involved in. We in the West, in European countries specifically, same in England, same in Sweden, it's more difficult for us. I mean, I know you said that there are comparison things, so it's not that you can't compare, but if we were to get to the root of what your people, what my people were involved in, we do have some material, of course, available to us. There are chronicle works, there are sagas and things like this, but it's definitely more difficult, because I think that the transformation that we've seen in other parts of the world occurred first in Europe. That's where some of the first areas where this knowledge was eradicated, which makes it so much more difficult for us, you know?
Absolutely. And then they sent the missionaries out to Africa, India, and everywhere else. But it was a impetus that came from Rome. And I believe we still are under that same impetus. It just shapeshifts a little bit and moves its center of gravity. It did originally come out of Rome. It came out of initially Emperor Constantine, who wanted to use Christianity to cement his empire, the Roman Empire. And this was in, I think, 300 and something. I can't remember the exact date. And so he decided that Christianity looked to be a good bet for that. And there were lots of philosophical schools in Rome that were practicing Christianity, but in a Gnostic way, in a mystic way, in the sense that of there was a Christ figure in their stories, but the stories were more mythical than they were history. It was about they were myths. It was about a mythical sun god, actually. And he literalized that and made it a historical person of Jesus Christ. And then that was kind of imposed at the end of a sword, you know, right the way through Europe, Scandinavia, Britain, they came in here. And it was like rolling out a carpet. I mean, I often talk about story mats when I'm talking about this. And about how always throughout history there would be these roaming storytellers that would go around, you know, turn up in a village, unroll their story mat under the tree. The village would all gather around them and they would be told a story. And the story was usually to support the political narrative of the king. What happened here was that, you know, they laid down the, you know, Abrahamic narrative, which was like wall-to-wall carpet, you know.
Yeah.
Never mind the story bug, it was wall-to-wall carpet throughout the whole of this part of the world.
Yeah.
And then, so anyone wanting to dig underneath that this is where they come in with the racism and the, you know, you're accused of racism, as they did Mercy Elliott, or anti-Semitism, which is not anti-Jewish people at all. It's just, excuse me, I just want to dig under your story to find my own, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and the same thing happened to Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell did a lot of really good work with myths, with comparative mythology, digging under the Abrahamic wall-to-wall carpeting. Also Jung, Carl Jung as well, did a lot of good work. And these people always get accused of being racist, accused of anti-Semitic, when all they're trying to do is recover their own mythology, the stories of their own ancestors, because that's where we know that's where our strength lies, in our own blood, in our own DNA.
Yeah, well, I guess to a certain extent that might be true. That might be seen like that by the antagonist then, because if the Judaic Abrahamic kind of view of things and the imposed worldview that came with that is something that's lying on top of ours, then we have to break through that. We have to crack that open in order to get to our own story, so to speak. So whatever, people can view that however they want. It's the time to be trying to defend ourselves for offending other people, I think is over. We just have to grab to it and get to it as close as fast as possible before we get to worse. But I would say, despite all these things, though, I would say, not to linger maybe on this point too long, but I think that Roman Catholicism was an element that at least was closer to our pagan past than the reformational movements were later. I think today, I've made this comparison before, but I think today with Protestantism, Lutheranism, etc., that is something that's brought us much closer to the kind of world that we live in today with scientificism, and we've seen the scientific field kind of come out of the Protestant movement and Calvinism and these kinds of things, which shows that, the scientific field is, of course, rooted, as you said before, in a kind of a religious belief-based system. But nonetheless, it's excluded so much, where at least Roman Catholicism still had some of the elements of different saints. It still had a very vivid kind of imagery and things like this, which I feel, in a way, was more closer to our past, our pagan past.
Yes, yes. I don't actually like to use the word pagan, though, because I think it, as I understand it, pagan is a word that was used by the Romans when they were referring to us in a derogatory way.
Sure.
It meant
peasant.
It meant ignorant peasant. But as we now know, the peasants were anything but ignorant. So I use the word pre-Christian. But I do agree with you, because I think certainly studying the history of Glastonbury in Somerset, where I'm now living, and this used to be the biggest abbey here, Glastonbury Abbey. This used to be the spiritual heart of England here. And it seems to me that the monks were mystics, at least. Some of them, I'm going back sort of 500 AD, 600 AD. But even, say, for example, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dunstan, was originally the Abbot of Glastonbury Abbey, going back to the 9th century, and he was a great friend of King Edmund. And he was most certainly, he was an alchemist, he was very druidic, very mystic, and I think if the Archbishop of Canterbury had those skills, then I'm certain that most of the monks would have been that way. I think Henry VIII actually sacked this abbey. He destroyed it on the pretext that the abbot wouldn't sign there was something they had to sign to say that King Henry VIII could marry Anne Boleyn divorce his Spanish wife. And they all did sign it, but it was used as the excuse to murder the abbot and two of his right-hand men quite graphic technicolor detail, which I probably won't go into. And then they sacked the abbey and destroyed it. And I think it was then, from then onwards, that King Henry VIII decided, he was going to be the head of the English church. And his daughter Mary came in for a brief time and tried to reinstate Catholicism, but she was only in for a very short time. Then we had Queen Elizabeth I, and I think she was a bit of a pragmatist. I know for sure she had alchemists and astrologers in her court, like John Dee, for example. And a lot of the Shakespearean stuff came out of that time. And if you look at some of it, it's definitely allegorical for magical practices. So I whoever the Shakespeare writer was, and we still don't really know, we think they were possibly Venetians that had been invited into the court of Elizabeth. But there's so much magical knowledge in Shakespeare, if you know what to look for. So this is, I think what happens with it is it goes underground and it's kept by the most powerful in the land to become more powerful and to disempower the masses and to make the masses more controllable. Certainly then after that, James I wrote a very famous book called Demonology. And there was a great witch hunt then against anybody that practiced any kind of magic. I think that was probably the last of it. It was really driven underground then. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, working around here at Glastonbury, we're working as well with the land, with the spirits of the land, and with the ley lines. It seems to us that there are particular ley lines that are associated with sovereignty and with kingship. And I've written a little bit about this on my blog, and I've also written about it in my book, Sacred Sex Rites of Ishtar, which is about sovereignty, actually. The whole book is about the sovereignty of comes from the land, comes from the spirits of the land, and how it used to be transmitted to the king on the night of his coronation. I don't know if they still do that. They've also taken something out of the coronation service, which indicates to me that they're not now abiding by that.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. Now, let me return to that question in terms of how we can get in touch with our ancestors and these kinds of issues through the land as well, because I remember just about a week ago, maybe a little bit more now, we linked up a very interesting video. It's actually about, it's another story perhaps, you have interesting history in England with, of course, Celts, you have Anglo-Saxons and things like this, but this particular one was a story about Sutton Hoo, the amazing ship burial that was found in 1939, and the story that was pretty interesting because it was I don't know what she was. Her name was Edith Pretty, and she was the landowner of Sutton Hoo. She was living in a house at the time, but allegedly she had a companion, I guess, or a friend of hers that were actually visiting at some point, and she had this very vivid dream one night about armies marching over these mounds, and this was actually her dream was actually one of the things that led to the discovery, because Edith, she actually decided to bring in an archaeologist at that point, and actually she pinpointed them where to dig. And it's just a pretty interesting story like that. But it's indicative to me of something deeper, I guess, that it's something still tied to the land. That you know, this is called Britain's Own Valley of the Kings, I guess, and it's one of those stories where you realize that there's something more going on than just the physical. It's something metaphysical to this. Have you heard this story before?
I know about the burial at Sutton Hoo, but I didn't know about the dream. It's lovely to hear about that. It makes absolute sense to me, because when I talk about a shaman going into trance, it's just the kind of controlled dream, really. Or maybe it's better put if I say that a dream is actually an involuntary shamanic journey. And it's difficult to get your head around that, because we're taught that dreams are just our imagination, or it's just something spinning out of our brain at the end of the day, and it's meaningless. And, you know, or sometimes psychologists do talk about interpreting dreams, but still in terms of it being psychology and not in terms of it actually being spirits giving you messages and talking to you through that dream space. But perhaps when we look at the Australian Aboriginal shamanism, and they use the word dream time, you can start to see how there is that connection. And some of my visions do come to me in dreams, usually when I'm waking up in the morning, and some of them come when I say, now I'm going to do a shamanic journey, and I go and lie down on my sofa and I go and I do it deliberately, there is qualitatively, there's very little difference between the two. And it's only in our dreams, our visions, when we access that part of ourselves, that ancestral wisdom, ancestral memory, that we start to, be in touch with something useful. Because a lot of the time we're in that other part of our brain, which has been trained in the Western way, which is all about materialism. You know, so even Western science is really Western material science, even though we're told that in an atom is 99% 0.9% space, and only very little matter in an atom. It's all space mainly. But science is devoted to the matter and not space. And that's because they don't have the tools to research the space. But the shaman does, and the dreamer does. And so does everybody when they want to access that part of themselves. It is their birthright. It's been educated out of us. I don't know whether it was deliberately educated out of us or whether it was just lost. It almost doesn't matter. We need to get it back. That's the important thing to concentrate on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very interesting development, I guess, because there's a tremendous progression here into the material world, which has been, I mean, it's unprecedented. If we look at other cultures, there's definitely something there. A lot of good things have come out of it, too. It's not only bad things, but there are some bad things as well. But just this aspect that we've, I think one of the reasons why the West is undergoing a kind of an identity crisis today and is kind of lost is that we've gone into the material world with such force and fervor and kind of left the metaphysical behind it to a certain extent. And as I said, I think partially of that, some good things have come out of that. So it's not only that, but I think that when we lose this connection to our ancestors, when the drive is so much to go forward all the time that we don't think about our past, it's almost like we've moved so fast that we don't have the stability in our past. So it's so easy to waver and lose our way, and that's where I think we are today. And on top of this, of course, we have this aspect that many people have been, you know, driven off the land. It's kind of an extension to the enclosure movement that you guys had in Britain, perhaps not as forceful and radical, but we do have things like Agenda 21 and issues of course, employment not being available anymore in rural areas. We don't have the sense of community anymore. People are getting they're getting pushed together, almost forced together, and they get very, very isolated at the same time, which is kind of a contradiction. But how important is the land to be able to get in touch with our ancestors, to be able to find this thing that we've lost in the West?
The first thing, I will talk about that, but the first thing I want to address is what you were saying, something about how we fell away from this, how the material, how the concentration on the material, and I think it comes down to our view of time. I think when we do get under all the Abrahamic wall-to-wall carpeting, we find stories that are about time being circular, or time being spiral, being vortical, in fact, because everything in nature is vortical. Nothing, even a tree has rings, you know, or if you see a plant growing, and they speed up the film, you'll see it doesn't go straight up. It just whips around, you know, in a kind of vortical motion upwards. So everything in nature moves in that way. It's not a straight line. But we came away because of the current, you know, education system teaches us that history is a straight line, in which we're getting better and better and better at something, and we're evolving. It's social evolution, it's called, based on Darwinism, and we're just going forward. But we're not acknowledging the circular bit, the round bit that we need to be doing, because you can't move forward in that way, and you'll crash basically if you try to. And I think that's what's happening now. I think we are crashing. I think that it's almost like there's a huge truck rolling down a hill and the brakes are broken, and it's just careering down a hill and no one can stop it.
Yeah.
The trajectory was set when they changed over to this linear view of history. And so, you know, you could perhaps take it back to Constantine even, although there were more people involved than that. So this view of history has given us this truck careering down a hill with the brakes off. And I don't think anyone's in control of it. I think they would quite like it if we found a solution. But in the meantime, they're going to make loads of money out of it because they understand better than us what's actually happening and how they can make money out of it, because they're in the secret societies that decide these things. But the secret societies now are not in touch with the land, and they're not in touch with the spirits of the land. And so to get back to what you said, what you asked, so the spirits of the land exist in another dimension. And perhaps shall I talk something a little bit about the cosmology of the shaman?
Sure, yeah.
World he journeys into to help you understand this a little bit. So the shaman journeys into three worlds. There's an upper world, a middle world, and a lower world. And the lower world is the world, it's hard to describe. I don't want to describe it too much anyway because I don't want to preempt anyone going there and seeing it and then thinking that they imagined it because I said so. But primarily it's about finding your power animal guide in the lower world. And your power animal is usually half animal, half human, in the same way that, say, a centaur is half animal, half human. I mean, this comes from the ancient Greeks, but the ancient Greeks were shamans. I mean, Plato, all those guys, Pythagoras, they were ecstatics.
Let me push the pause button there. Remember where you are. I just wanted to interject and mention, look at, for example, in the Norse world where we have the stories of Beowulf, for example, who wear a boar's head on top of his head. The boar was very prominent. You had, of course, the idea of the berserker, of a bear symbol, half man, half bear. This is all over Northern Europe. You guys have it in England too, of course. So I just want to mention that.
Yeah, definitely. It is everywhere. That's the whole point about it. It's different nationalities have different animals, and, you know, because they're different. And that brings us back to this thing of race again, that everyone is different. But yes, so the lower world, you go to find your power animal. And when you find your power animal, you recognize them and you know you've been with them before. It's a great, wonderful feeling of familiarity. It's even if you've got a fierce one like a lion or something like that, it's a wonderful experience to find your power animal. So I always teach people that bit first of going down to the lower world to find their power animal and to explore down there as well and to learn about that part. And then I teach them to journey to the upper world. And the upper world is much more, you will find your spirit guide there and he'll be much more, or she'll be much more human or humanoid, maybe someone like an angel or just some half, more human than the animal side of it. And how you journey to those places is up and down your axis mundi, which very often is a tree, and this is where the world tree imagery comes from. So you start off imagining yourself sitting in a tree. You say, you make the intention to go down to the lower world, so you go down to the lower world, or you make the intention to go up to the upper world. And usually something comes to carry you and pick you off and take you there. The very first bits of it are in your imagination. You have to say, okay, I'm going to do this and imagine it. And then it takes over. And then it's no longer you making it up. It's happening like a dream. But then there is the middle world. And the middle world is different, again, because I didn't really start working in the middle world at all until I came to Glastonbury 4 years ago and realized that actually Glastonbury is on a fairy ring. It's on a fairy circle. There's this huge circle here of earthworks. They are 30 miles in perimeter. There are 13 of them, and they tell the story. They tell a very similar story to the monomyth of Joseph Campbell. And it's incredibly old. I mean, we think it's been here about 2,500 years, something like that. Mm. And so that story is being told on the land. Now, as I'm still very much learning about this, and how I'm learning about it is by journeying into it. And it's, you know, this is a middle world journey, and talking to the entities that I meet there that are known locally as the Fae or the Fairies or the Gentry. They have lots of different names, and there are spirits of the land everywhere. I mean, those are just the names we use around here. And they are guiding me along with my ancestors. Well, there comes a point where you sort of realize your ancestors, and for some people, your ancestors and the Fae are kind of, they've been working together a long time. If you go right back to your very early ancestors, and the relationship between man and Fae is very, very old, very ancient, very beautiful. And it was always that man and Fae worked in partnership with the land, and that created the fertility of the land, and each respected the other's part in it.
You wrote about something interesting too, about how the king is seen as one who's marrying the land. That this idea of the king is not—we're actually very foreign to this concept today, especially in the West. We don't have, of course, true regents. We don't have honorable and noble regents. It's quite the opposite. We have misleaders. But I think one of the reasons too is that we've lost our way with our connection to a king as a representation for and of the people. That this was, in my view anyway, not still a top-down kind of, tyranny per se.
Yeah.
Certainly there was direction by the king, but a just king, a good king, ruled, of course, with intention what is best for his people. So that is very different back then as opposed to how it is today.
Even, say, for example, at the time of King Alfred the Great, who is very much associated with this land around here. So it seemed to me, you know, this is the 9th century, seemed to me that he had more of our, you know, the people's needs at heart than kings and queens today. But I think if we, again, go back to shamanism and go back thousands of years, and you find tribes where the shaman was the most important person, not because he was richer than anybody else, he probably wasn't, but he was listened to along with the elders. So the shaman and the elders were considered to be the most important because they were in touch with the spirits, and so they could get that wisdom, they could get the guidance, the information that was needed. And then as time went on, and we didn't really start having kings until I think we settled down to, stopped being hunter-gatherers and went into the agricultural phase,
mm-hmm.
Which varies all over Europe and Mesopotamia. But I think it started probably about 7,000 BC, something like that. And then we start to see emerging kings and chieftains. But they were always appointed by the shaman and the elders.
Exactly.
So they were the second rung down, and then the next rung down were the artisans, and the next rung down were the merchants. If you look at the old Indian caste system, I mean, not that I'm in favor of the caste system, but it's a remnant of it. And the merchants are number four, really low down on the ladder. Whereas now we are being run by the merchants.
Yeah,
somehow
that's right.
The merchant bankers have got into that prime position. And they're only interested in making money. And so that, you know, that's what everything is all about. And we're seen as just tools to make money for them.
Yeah.
But they're not seeing the real human being. I'm pretty sure most of them are completely ignorant of these matters. I know there's a lot of talk about secret societies doing magic and having knowledge of the occult, but my experience is I don't think they're much to worry about, to be honest. I think they've more or less lost it. That's just my view.
Well, this is just it. They're constantly being blamed for maybe not only being Satanists all the time, but they are the pagans. You know, they are the ones who are into the occult. We hear this all the time, of course, and I think it's as far away as you can get from this. It doesn't mean, though, that they, of course, are not using principles that in the ancient days were associated with the occult, like, for example, knowledge of of psychology or how to manipulate people. I mean, marketing could be argued as a kind of an occult art. If the perceiver is not aware that he's being manipulated, yeah, then it is. But it's not you know, paganism as we're as most people are thinking about it, right? So it's a huge difference there to me.
Yes, because you know there are some people that view paganism through a Christian lens, and in that way would think magic equals evil, but magic is actually just nature quickened, and alchemists know how to quicken nature because they watch how nature does it, and that's all it is. But I think, you know, the lot that are in charge at the moment, whatever we want to call them, I think they are just using theatre. And to say that they can do magic is part of their theatre. I do think it's 99.9% theatre. And if you're bought into their theatre, then it's real.
Yeah.
But it's always been about, you know, as we were talking about, going back to the story, Matt, you know, it's always been about story and narrative. But now they've got the propaganda machine, the mainstream media. They can tell any story they want. And if people aren't spiritually awake to see through it, then they will believe it. I don't think it matters too much. If people talk a lot about, oh, when are they going to wake up? You know, that's a quite famous thing on the alternative media. I don't think it matters. I don't think it is a matter of numbers. I think it's a matter of frequency. I think a certain frequency will be reached when it's reached, when there are enough people awake. I don't think it has to be more people awake than aren't awake, necessarily. It's qualitative, not quantitative, I think.
Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit more then about some of the aspects that are being denied or omitted, I guess, constantly from the majority of the mainstream media in a way, which touches upon the issue we want to get to here of race. And you talked before about, of course, the rivers of blood, as it was called, the metaphysical aspect to DNA, and that this is what ties us to our past. It's both who we are as a composition physically, but it's also something that ties us to the traditions and to the ways of our ancestors. And I feel that they've worked very hard on severing this connection. And every time you bring up the aspect that you're concerned over the fact that, you know, this that your people is being targeted in different ways, and I think we can clearly see this in Europe more than any other place in the world at the moment, and in the way that this is happening as well, and on top of it then, in the way that this is being denied, or in the way that you're basically pointed out as being a racist for the fact that you're concerned for your own people, where basic self-preservation now equates to hatred and violence against others, which is, of course, a ridiculous you know, leap to make. But nonetheless, there it is, and that's what's happening right now. Why do you think that this is such an important thing for them, then, to try to eradicate and destroy race as a way to sever us from our own connection to our past?
I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. I can only see what the results of it are. And I think sometimes I look at it and I think, do you know what? This has all the hallmarks of a classic rite of passage. I wrote about this recently, actually. If you were to imagine there was someone above them, okay, because we always think they're on top, but imagine that there's just lots and lots of layers above them, as there are. Then it looks to me, there is this thing that they, and I think they still do it in indigenous tribes, but they certainly always used to. You may have had, I think you may have had him on, Maledoma Patrice Somme, who's a shaman, West African shaman. He wrote about his rite of passage in Burkina Faso when he was made into a shaman. Anyway, the children at the age of about 14 are taken out into the woods and they're taught bushcraft and they're taught various shamanic techniques that they probably know anyway because they live in that kind of society. So they probably don't need much help with that. But they have certain lessons and the elders are with them. And then suddenly the elders disappear. And sometimes the elders stage their own death. And then the children are just left to find their way back. And the only way they can do it is to get in touch with their ancestral wisdom through their own rivers of blood. But Manidoma talks about being buried up to his neck in sand in order to go through this pain in great discomfort anyway, great restriction, it's very hot, to put him in touch with that. It's a kind of quickening like you see in nature where, I mean, one example of quickening, okay, I'll give you an example, is because it's about to happen in March, there's suddenly this cold snap. It goes suddenly really, really cold for about a few days, and that's because then the sap is forced up the stalk and towards the sun to get the warmth. And that's why you suddenly get this burgeoning spring, it's called, you know, because everything springs up. But it's actually a quickening that nature does to get it moving. In the same way, this to me has all the hallmarks of that. Whether it is or not, I don't know. But I think it's quite useful to use it as a model because it takes away all the, oh, but why are they so awful and why are they doing this? And maybe if I sign that petition, it might help. And all that time wasting that we're doing when, in fact, you know, there's a lion coming towards us in the jungle and we've got to band together and work out what we're going to do about this lion. We don't do that bit because we're still in trauma. And I understand that because there is also this cycle of trauma that is the wake up, that you start off being in denial, then you're very angry, then you're very fearful. You go through all these different emotions as you're waking up. But we are at a stage now where I think there's enough of us awake to think, okay, we're really in danger. Our race is in danger. We have a perfect right to protect our own race more than have the right to protect our own race. And what are we going to do? I think even in realizing that, things would change.
Mm-hmm.
And in allowing ourselves, you know, not to keep turning the other cheek, as they taught us to do, and not keep rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar. Well, I'm not saying that people shouldn't pay their taxes, but it's this whole attitude of not being able to speak, not being able to say what you think. Language fascism is huge at the moment, political correctness. And just ignoring all that and just saying, I'm sorry. I mean, I have a right to defend who I am, and that's what I'm going to do. You don't have a right to come to my land and take everything I have. It's really simple. The truth is really simple, but they've made it so complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when this whole thing about immigration, for example, if you say you believe in controlled immigration, which we always had in this country, because we're a small island, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Suddenly you're a racist, you know, whereas the thing is, you can't have uncontrolled immigration. It's nothing to do with racism, it's economics. You can't have uncontrolled immigration and a welfare state, both together.
Yeah, that's
right. You have one or you have the other.
Yeah.
You know. It's just very, very practical things. It's as if common sense has been turned on its head. And if anyone says anything from that common sense point of view, they're, you know, accused of something or the other. So it's really going beyond that and thinking, okay, whether everyone else is going to wake up or not, I have to make sure that I'm really awake. I have to make sure that I'm firing on all cylinders. What am I missing? What am I missing? And actually what people are mainly missing is the spiritual wake up, which is a very practical thing. It's a very, it's to do with the ecstasy that I was talking about. And I explained it in my book, The Sacred Sex Rites of Ishtar, because the sex rites with the king were to transmit the sovereignty from the land to the king. But it was an actual thing that happened with inside of both of them. So there was this extreme feeling of ecstasy and enlightenment and also game changing. It's completely game changing. It's like taking the red pill of the matrix. Once you've taken it, nothing looks the same again. And it fires up something called the uraeus, and that fires up the higher brain centers. And that's the ultimate wake up. And that happens through shamanism, through the shamanic ecstasy of working with your spirit guides.
Yeah, I'm so curious about the pacification here of why more people aren't waking up and seeing what actually is happening around us. The denial that there's no concern here, that the that the misinformation about, you know, that you know, that race doesn't matter has so permeated the educational field and the pop culture as well, that people lack that basic, I mean, survival instinct. That, and I think it's true that when a civilization forgets its ancestors, they, of course, very soon stop thinking about their descendants. They don't have, there's no connection between them and the past. It's what you say. It's like a disjointed moment in time that is not connected with either the past or our future. And if we don't show an interest in our roots, in the importance of culture, of our ancestors, why would the children that we're raising in our world, they would have no interest in this whatsoever. And that's how you sever that connection. And I think personally that this is a way for the elements that are, well, competing with us, for the lack of a better term. There are a myriad of theories about this. This is what we talk about on the show, of course. Who is in control? Why are they doing it? And there's tons of them out there. We don't have to go into all the intricacies of them now. We only have to say that it is something, a force out there, that it's seeking the destruction, I think, of the European people. And we're allowing it to happen. And I think that, you know, they're lying on 100% basically all the time, pressuring, pushing, doing everything they can. We, the majority of people anyway, are not even on 1% of setting up an opposition to that. If we could even get to that point, I think we would be in a much better position. But it's almost like they've made us drop our guard and drop our association to who we are or even the importance of ourselves. And that's what's leading to these horrible conditions that we now are seeing, Ishtar.
Yes, I absolutely agree. It's absolutely incredible what they've achieved in such a short time. Actually, I think they're waiting for my generation to die, and then they, you know, because we're the only ones probably that still can remember skies that don't have chemtrails in. You know, you hear people say, "Well, they've always been there." And they haven't been, you know, only, well, from where I live, they haven't been. They've been there the last 15 years, I'd say, you know. But so they also have a very long game plan, which, because we've lost contact with our ancestors, we don't have. We're not organized. We don't even feel connected to our own DNA. So how can we feel connected to each other? They've been very clever in how they've done this. I mean, one example is, I don't know if you have it in your country, I think you probably don't, but we have, at the beginning of November, we have something called Remembrance Sunday, where everyone wears a red poppy and goes to the Whitehall, and there's the old soldiers march past, and it's all, they say it's to remember war. It's to remember world wars.
Yeah.
Actually is a bit of a celebration of it, but they won't use that word.
Oh, this is our religion of our times, I'd say. God, for Christ's sake, the Second World War, the Holocaust, I mean, these are the pillars of cultural heritage in the Western world right now, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So this is actually at the beginning of November. Now, our ancestors, the Celts, who were the original Brits, you know, before the Anglo-Saxons came in, but even the Anglo-Saxons, I think, would have had this time of the year, and it's called Samhain, and it's the time for remembering the ancestors. So you would actually use that time to be in contact with the ancestors, to remember the ancestors, to honor them, to give offerings to the land in remembrance of them. And this would go on for days, and it was a very, very important part of the calendar of the year. But they plonked their Remembrance Sunday on there. So now it's just a Sunday, and the only dead that you're remembering are the ones who fought in the bankers' wars, and not everybody. So that's how they've done it. It seems that at every turn, they have destroyed the memories of how we get back home, basically. So now we are like orphans standing there with nothing. But having said that, if this is a rite of passage, if this is all about getting the human being to wake up, they would have to do all that, because once the human being is awake, all bets are off. And so they had to make sure that there was no trace of it anywhere. So they bury the myths, and they bury, you know, even archaeology is riddled with it. It's absolutely riddled with this narrative, this Darwinian narrative, and anything that goes against that you know, when they find signs of our ancestors' great intelligence 300,000 years ago, well, it's buried, basically. And the archaeology, I used to have a forum called Ishtar's Gate, and I used to have lots of archaeologists on there that couldn't get their work through the peer review system because of this. You know, they were vilified sometimes out of their positions in the universities for making these discoveries that didn't fit in with Darwinism. So that was a huge one, Darwinism.
Well, and I got to interject there too, Isha, because what I've noticed, I think that it's been partially maybe a tool, you know, to try to steer us in a certain direction. But I've noticed lately that even now, Darwinism, this is how they do it. I mean, again, we could see the same thing as with the church. It's a progression. You step up to one step, right, and then people adjust, acclimatize and adjust to that. Then you take it to the next level, etc. With the sciences of biology and human biodiversity, now even Darwinism is becoming politically incorrect because it points towards differences between people. And I've seen this everywhere now that it's like, no, you know, now they're turning their back on even on that because it shows some of the, that it contradicts some of the more politically correct ideas that they're trying to push. So I find that very fascinating, how they're using what they can at the time in order to push the agenda and change our perception of the world, you know?
Yes, I think at the root of it is this spiritual awakening, because once you have undergone this spiritual awakening, you no longer are dependent on believing that the bad parent is a good parent. But until then, you have, you're almost like in a raft at sea, and there's, you know, the perfect storm building, and you've just got this flimsy raft. And so you would cling on to anything that came along in that storm, including, and this is what they mainly rely on, that your government has your best interests at heart.
Right.
But once you learn to sail and, you know, learn to ride the storm, you can look it in the face and see it for what it is and have the strength to see it for what it is. So really that's just a metaphor. It's like most people haven't even switched on the, if you think of the human experience like a computer. I mean, I remember my dad, my dad died a few years ago, but he lived until his early 90s, and he was the secretary of the Bowls Club, and he used to have to type up the minutes of the Bowls Club meeting every month, and he had this kind of cranky computer, typewriter, really old-fashioned typewriter. So one day we bought him a computer. And he just thought this was wonderful because now he could type up the minutes of the Bowls Club, and he doesn't have to use Tippex if he makes a mistake, and, you know, all the benefits of typing on a computer. But he never learned how to use email, and he never went anywhere near the internet. And we're like that, you know, the human beings that aren't awake are like that. They've got the operating system, it's already in there, but they need to be shown how to download it, how to get, you know, get it to work, how to browse, you know, how to find search engines, that sort of thing. And then once they've done that, they're away. Most people are using their human experience, like my dad was using the computer just to type up the minutes of the Bowls Club.
Well, why don't we can take a short break here in a little bit between the segments, and then we can pick up and talk more in the second here. But why don't you give us some of your websites, and also, of course, you have a book out there. I want you to mention that, and you can tell us a bit briefly about what is in the book. It's called The Sacred Sex Rites of Ishtar. Tell us more about that.
Well, the book actually does go into all of this, and it looks at how, going back even as far as the Neanderthals, they were practicing this kind of shamanic sexual healing with the spirits of the land. So this is where all my work has come from. That's why I had Ishtar's Gate, the forum with the archaeologists on, because I was really researching this and looking to see how far back we could see shamanism. And what I found was, yes, shamanism, but also these sex rites going back a long, long way. And the purpose of them is, as I described, to get that operating system fired up. And so I show in my book, I go right the way back and show it and then bring it forward to the modern day and show how it was buried as well. And then in the second half of the book, I explain how we can do this ourselves. I mean, you will need a shaman to initiate you, but even for the beginner that doesn't want to go that far, there are still exercises in there for them as well. So there's certain techniques that they can use and do to start to learn this way again. And I've been training a few people, and they're getting it quite well, so it does work. So that's that book, and I've also got a book about my time in India, and I studied the Vedas in India. I've been studying mythology most of my life, and you know, I spent some time in India in the 90s and in the ashram of Satya Sai Baba, and so I've written a book called Lord of the Dance about that. I have a blog called Ishtar Bhagavadudinga, and if you just Google that, you'll get it, but it's on WordPress as well. I also have a more holistic health forum called theholisticworks.com. Sorry, that's a blog, not a forum. Theholisticworks.com, where that's mainly about health, holistic health. There is some shamanism on there, but it's more about shamanic healing, mind, body, spirit, shamanic healing. I think that's it.
All right. Yeah, very good. We'll have the links, of course, up there to istarsgate.com and the WordPress site as well, theholisticworks.com, and a link to the book. The books are available on the website too, by the way, so you have them on the right-hand side right there if you want to click in and read more about that. So, all right, we'll take a short break. Ladies and gentlemen, stay with us, Ishtar, and we'll return shortly after a break. We return in the second hour. We'll speak more about blood and soil and how to stay connected to the land in opposition to the way modernity is driving us off the land. We'll speak more about the important sites in England like Burrell's Mump, Glastonbury Tor, and some other sites as well. Later we speak about immigration into the British Isles, overpopulation, true environmentalism, Islam in Britain, and also the most horrible effects of the current repressive, politically correct climate that leads to things like Rotherham and now Halifax more recently. Absolute horrendous crimes that has led to the destruction of over 1,400 young English girls' lives. we speak more about how easy it is for Westerners or Europeans to go all over the world to look for a deeper spiritual connection instead of looking at what we have, where we come from, and see our ancestors' traditions. People tend to go for Buddhism, Hinduism, New Age, or all other kinds of trappings and isms that isn't ours. The reason for this is a combination of guilt and, of course, no racial consciousness whatsoever, as it's been completely bred out of us through education and entertainment media. We'll also speak more about the king, the true king, as an archetype, and how we've lost this symbol today as we despise our leaders. And unfortunately, for good reason. We'll speak more about King Alfred the Great as an interesting example. But this is an interesting continuation ahead here with Ishtar Babilu Dingir, and I'll ask you a bit more about her name too, by the way. So to tune in here to the second hour, go to redicemembers.com and sign up for membership with us. And of course, get full access to all our previous shows, close to 1,000 programs on a lot of different topics. So take a look in our archives and see what we have for you. We'll be back here shortly with Sally Fallon, John Friend, E. Michael Jones, Gilad Atman, Matt Forney, and many more. For now, I say thank you for listening, but do stay tuned. We'll be right back. RedIceMembers.com is the website.